Special Saturday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. No game Thursday, pretty much no game Friday, and now a little bit more competitive this Golden State San Antonio game. We also got some other goodies coming up with our reaction to the All-NBA teams, and then a look at Florida State freshman combo forward Jonathan Isaac for our draft preview series, as what we previously did Jason Tatum earlier in the week. Going to try to get to Josh Jackson pretty soon here as well for you. We're sponsored today by Bespoke Post. Try thepost.com/capspace, or you can use the capspace code at checkout and get 20% off your first box. I will tell you more about them momentarily. Danny, why don't we actually start with news here, because these games were both rather uninteresting. And of course, the place to start is maybe part of why the game was so uninteresting, although you imagine nothing could have stopped Cleveland in those first two games anyway. Isaiah Thomas is done for the season.
Are you, did you set it up that way so I have to read what the injury is?
No, but I could do it. Basically he's got a labral tear in his hip, which is something we've seen from Gerald Henderson. He's had two hip surgeries. Wilson Chandler's had two hip surgeries. LaMarcus Aldridge has had two hip surgeries. Just like you have your labrum in your shoulder, you have it also in your hip. It's another ball and socket joint. And so you have to imagine that surgery will be coming for Thomas. He initially injured it, according to the Celtics, on March 15th against Minnesota, missed two games, and then he aggravated even further during game 6 against Washington, a game where he played very well down the stretch until he had a couple of turnovers, and then obviously had a heroic performance in game 7 along with Kelly Olynyk to get them to this point. But you and I were noting on the Twitter NBA show that he just did not have any kind of explosion. I mean, he was trying to drive by Deron Williams, just like couldn't get past him, like couldn't do anything against Kyrie Irving, who and he shot a combined 1 of 14 in the two first halves, the only competitive portions of those games. So it seemed clear that he was not quite himself.
Absolutely. And it's certainly disappointing, even though it feels like Boston's playoff run is almost over anyway. It's just a formality, just because Isaiah had such a fabulous year. And the timing of this, you know, just in terms of everything that's going on with Boston, they have such a challenging, fascinating offseason with everything now that they got the number one pick.
Like 27 GMs would love to have that kind of a challenging offseason,
right?
I'm guessing.
Of course. But I mean, there are also sky high expectations and everything like that. So they and Isaiah factors into it in a couple different ways. I mean, you could see him just, you know, rolling it back with him and maybe just kind of holding pat for another year. But one of the other options was to try to move on from him. And that changes now, not only because he's, you know, he might have to have surgery, but because you wonder if the wonderful season he had, and I don't want to lose sight of what he did this year, that it really was hard, that it will be hard for him to repeat, even more so than it would have been otherwise.
Yeah, with him getting up into his late 20s now, I mean, the three-point shooting that he showed this year, maybe if that's real, he can still approach somewhat close to this level next year. But you have to imagine, especially if he does have surgery, and that hasn't been announced yet, by the way, maybe this is something that still can be managed without surgery. But if he can get back and be healthy by next year, you still think that, especially with the decline in athleticism that everyone experiences in their late 20s, that his finishing at the rim that made him so special, that actually has been on the decline since his Sacramento days even, may take it more of a nosedive. And he certainly, with this injury, saw quite a decline there in his ability to get to the basket late in this postseason run.
Well, and it's finishing at the rim, but it's also getting to the free throw line. His free throw attempt rate was 44.1 this year. That's really high for a lot of guys, but especially for a point guard. And so those things run together. If he can lose two of the kind of pillars of his efficient scoring offense, or at least just a reduction in them, it makes it harder for everything else to work.
In related news, Thomas said that he has been in touch with Markelle Fultz. Both of them went to Washington, of course. Fultz has said that he really wants to play with Isaiah Thomas. Those guys saying the right things at this point. Obviously, if Fultz comes in, I mean, I don't think it's going to really affect Isaiah that much as far as what kind of a season he'll have next year, because Fultz is just kind of not really going to be ready yet. And, you know, it is possible that if Fultz plays really well and the Celtics still, you know, don't sign Gordon Hayward, and they're not really, it's clear that the Celtics are not really in contention as far as like really competing with Cleveland next year, that maybe we could see them even move on from Avery Bradley and Thomas at the trade deadline as they really hit the reset button into this new era, you know, with Jaylen Brown, Fultz, and some of the younger guys. But that's a long way off still. We're still speculating there. Anything else we should say about that massacre on Friday night, in which we turned off the Twitter NBA show in the first half. This will probably be the only time we ever do that, as Boston trailed by 40 points when Kevin Love hit a three. We had agreed that if it got to 40 in the first half, we were going to turn it off, and we in fact did, as was seen in a somewhat comical fashion on the end of our dunked on video highlights, as it were.
Yeah, so for me, while Cleveland's offense was impressive, they did a great job in game one as well. The thing that I spent the most time focusing on in that just evisceration was LeBron James as a help defender, most notably, but as a defender overall, did an absolutely fabulous job.
Yeah, I think he probably had four or five stops at the rim in both of those first halves. Boston shot, I want to say, under 40% in the restricted area in the first halves of this series. I think there are 6 out of 17 in game two, which obviously is not very good. I mean, they were getting there 17 shots and a half. That's great. But LeBron was just intimidating everyone. And they don't really have guys with the juice off the dribble to finish, even when LeBron is in there. Tristan Thompson did an okay job as well. We'll see whether they can still be this effective against Golden State, specifically against Kevin Durant. And that really seems to be the only question that remains. With Thomas out now, though, just out of curiosity, like, what would your starting lineup be for the Celtics going into game three?
I would start Terry Rozier because I want to see how he does defensively in this matchup. I mean, it's a good little stress test for him just to see how it goes. You're not going into this with expectations, so just try it out. Be ready to move away to somebody like Marcus Smart if it doesn't work. But I think that's the right place to at least begin this journey.
Yeah, and I'd like to see Jaylen Brown get more time too. And because they're really going to have no offensive engine now, I'd like to see them actually just put the ball in Jaylen Brown's hands. Really, I mean, unfair to him that the first time that's going to happen is in the conference finals, but see if he can run a pick and roll, see if he can actually like post guys up and do an ISO against mismatches, try to get Kyrie on him, put him down in the post, see what happens. I mean, it's not going to work, but at least you get a chance to see whether these flashes that he's shown as really the only Celtic who could do anything getting to the basket actually will continue and give him a good stepping stone for next season. In other news, my old boss at Basketball Insider, Steve Kyler, reporting that a $20 million a year deal for Serge Ibaka seems to be done, that is the expectation around the league that deal would get done. And $20 million seems about fair for Ibaka's contribution. Certainly had a disappointing playoffs offensively. I thought defensively actually played well, especially in that Bucks series. Masai Ujiri saying that he sees him as more of a center, which will be interesting for Jonas Valanciunas in that case, who still is under contract there for a while longer, making over $15 million a year. But the question then, as you always say, is years, not dollars. If that's a 3-year $20 million deal, I think I'm cool with it. That fourth year could get really ugly. And then the other issue is, what does that mean for the potential return of Kyle Lowry? I mean, you'd think that the first thought there is that Ibaka would resign. But this Ibaka could also be another Nene test guy from the man who spawned the term back with Nene signing him after the lockout in Denver. So maybe that's another thought, is just, hey, we're not going to let this guy get away.
And considering the Raptors have so few ways to improve their team, that can make some sense. Again, it gets into the years, not dollars idea. And this was always in the back of my mind because I had heard at various points in time that Ujiri and Ibaka had a relationship because of Basketball Without Borders and numerous other things that existed long before he was a member of the Raptors. And so, you know, maybe he was more open to signing there or something like that. And Toronto was in this situation where they needed to get a sense with him because their offseason would look very different if he just left without compensation.
Kyler did do a little CYA in saying that it's possible he could get a better offer than this Toronto offer, but that he gave his personal opinion that seems unlikely. Executive news, some intrigue here with Woj reporting that Dan Gilbert, some expect him to basically cheap out on David Griffin because they've had success there with numerous general managers. I sure as hell wouldn't do that. I think Dave Griffin has done an awesome job and a much better one than his predecessor, Chris Grant, that's for sure. And probably a better one than his predecessor, Danny Ferry, as well. So, but, you know, maybe this is where Dan Gilbert's going to decide that all this luxury tax stuff, he's going to try and save money on executives. We'll see what LeBron James has to say about that as well. But there's still talk about Orlando and Atlanta having interest in Griffin as well. We have heard very little in terms of leaks out of Orlando of what's going to happen with them. They currently have Matt Lloyd, former Bulls scout and assistant GM, as their interim right now, and he's basically running their draft stuff. Maybe they are waiting around for David Griffin, and then, you know, they'll give, if that doesn't work, then maybe they'll just let Lloyd handle the ship. He's still supposed to be a candidate. But the silence out of Orlando, in marked contrast to what we've seen coming out of Atlanta, where they have apparently asked for permission to interview every single person under the sun, and it is leaked that they have asked for permission to interview every single person under the sun.
They are going the exhaustive route, and we'll have to see what kind of power this person is going to have. My questions with a front office is really who has final say, and then who is a voice in the room. And certainly this person would be a voice in the room, but there are going to be a lot of them, because Wes Wilcox is still technically in the organization.
Wes Wilcox is a special advisor to the owner, who didn't want him to retain as GM.
So is that the equivalent of Brian Scalabrine when Mark Jackson couldn't fire him and just basically sent him to the D League?
I mean, well, so over under how long before Wilcox actually leaves the organization? I mean, it's gonna happen by the end of this year, right? Like, you would have to imagine.
Depends on his contract.
Yeah, I guess so. And you know, maybe it's not like anyone else is clamoring to hire him yet, so maybe it behooves him to stick around a little bit. But Woj had a story that they asked for permission to talk to Neil O'Shea in Portland, their GM. Portland denied that, and that, you know, Atlanta even was willing to potentially give some compensation there. Tommy Shepard, Wizards assistant GM, has been talked about. They've asked for permission to interview Mark Hughes, player personnel for the Knicks. And there's like even a couple more people I'm forgetting about. Troy Weaver was discussed earlier. Oh yeah, Travis Schlenk, assistant GM with the Warriors. And so we have no idea where this is going. And right now, sounds like assistant GM Jeff Peterson is doing most of running the draft. And they have a capable staff, obviously, outside of Wes Wilcox. But it'd be very interesting. I understand why they'd want to be moving quickly here, but they're still kind of waiting on Griffin as well. So probably enough on that at all. Let's talk about this Warriors-Spurs game.
Golden State looked, well, they looked good in the first like 5 minutes or so when JaVale was in, and then they just fell off offensively and defensively. Some just truly horrible transition D from them, but then they ended up making their way back largely through a big third quarter from Kevin Durant. Durant had 19 points in the third quarter alone, as the Warriors ended up, they outscored them in the quarter and took a more stable lead. And I thought KD was he was a little bit passive, or just he wasn't that noticeable in the first half. He had some nice moments, but then in that third quarter he took over.
Yeah, and with their egalitarian system, that can happen. But I mean, he was scoring every which way. At one point scored 17 straight points for the Warriors. He had a couple of sweet back doors from David West, a couple of threes after he drove the lane and got a switch on Pau Gasol, and then ran out to the corner and got a three, hit a three over Manu Ginobili. I mean, you saw how limited the Spurs were at this point. They had Manu Ginobili, 39 years old, trying to guard KD, and Ginobili was unbelievable himself. He had two ridiculous highlights. He nutmegged David West. He probably finished over him at the rim like three or four more times as well. He was spectacular. But the Spurs, their offense actually was pretty good throughout most of the game, but they got enough minutes out of the Green at center units, which really ended up winning this game. I mean, they were actually up 12 late in the second quarter after going to Green at center, and then they took out Green and Curry to avoid getting them their fourth fouls, and the Spurs were able to come back a little bit until David West hit a corner three to put him up by nine. And the Spurs, I think, got back within like three or something, but it was all but over. I think the Warriors led by like 15 or 18 or something at the end of the third quarter.
One of the other disappointing developments of this game is that early on, David Lee was doing a nice job, including getting some catharsis, scoring on former eventual supplanter Draymond Green, which was impressive for David Lee. And then he landed awkwardly on a finish on an and one, actually, and he was removed from the game. He couldn't even shoot the free throw on the end one. And Michael C. Wright and Ramona Shelburne are reporting that the diagnosis is a partially torn patella. He's going to have an MRI on Sunday morning.
yeah, I actually have had that injury, and it really sucks to feel it's better than a totally torn patellar tendon when you can't even like have the ability to move your knee at all. But it's a really weird feeling when, like, when I did mine, I could just feel like half of it was torn, and then the like, and it was probably actually more like three quarters of it. So I'm like trying to bend my knee, and there's just like this little string of it that was still attaching and allowing me to bend my knee, and it just didn't feel very good. Then I drove home after I did that. And by the time I got home, it had swelled up to like the size of four softballs, and I had to like, you know, get help to get back inside. And then I got an MRI the next day and found out what I did. But anyway, you know, so he definitely, I'm sure, knew it right away that there were major issues, and you know, he had to get wheeled off and was very upset afterwards. It's too bad for him too, because I mean, in what's kind of was a meaningless game, he had a wonderful year, maybe was set up to get a better contract next year. The last guy who had a partially torn patella was Yusuf Nurkic, obviously a much younger player than Lee, who is 33 right now. And Nurkic, even it took him probably almost a year really to get back from that injury. So really devastating for David Lee. Sad to hear that from him. In other injury news, which I think is probably the most significant thing of this game, which we thought was fait accompli, the Warriors were going to win it. How did Andre Iguodala look to you in this game?
He looked slower than usual, and it's a challenge with Iguodala because he's adapted to not being the physical freak that he was early in his career very well, but he looked off to me, and a couple of weird finishes, including one where it looked like he landed off. He kind of went for an ambitious dunk try, and he made the shot, but the landing was strange. And then he got blown by at least three times. I think it might have even been more than that by DeJounte Murray. And
yeah, it was four actually.
While Iguodala is not the best defender on fast guys at this point in his career, it definitely didn't seem that way. But it looks like he's going to get plenty of rest. Even if this series ends up going five, he's still going to get plenty of rest.
He looked quite spry early on, and then he tweaked it last year. Similarly, he's had this left knee patellar tendonitis, which I'm pretty sure is what the diagnosis is, although I don't think we ever really quite got that, but that's something that he's had for a while. And again, because I've had left knee patellar tendonitis, I can tell you this, that when you try and take off of one foot, that's how you can really aggravate that. And especially as someone kind of went in underneath him on that layup attempt early on, he was very aggressive going to the rim, and then he kind of landed awkwardly. And I saw him similarly on a fast break dunk last year off his left foot kind of come down awkwardly, and it's really more about the takeoff than it is the landing sometimes on those plays. But so I think, and then he did look kind of hobbled, didn't play much more. I don't think he scored after that. You mentioned his defense was not that great, looked like he was kind of going at half speed. And it wouldn't shock me, actually, if he just sits out the next game. I was surprised he played in this one, frankly. But he did go through two full practices, but, you know, probably didn't try to dunk on anybody in those two full practices. So we'll see. But he'll have, I mean, what is it going to be? The finals start on June 1st, and they're probably going to win on Monday. So that's going to be like 10 days worth of rest. Hopefully that's enough for him.
Yeah, I think that should be. And also, this game featured some garbled rotations because of the foul trouble, including Steph Curry getting pulled in the first, coming back in the second. But he had a nice game overall. He had a couple of terrible turnovers, five total in the game, but thought he was active in passing lanes, ended up with seven deflections and six steals, and had a couple of just beautiful, beautiful finishes.
I think that Curry's foul trouble is Golden State's biggest weakness. Some of the games where they melted down, like game six, obviously, in Cleveland last year, it was because he got into foul trouble early. And against Cleveland, there's no team more likely to get him into foul trouble. Ironically, he stayed in. I don't know that he ever actually even got another foul after getting his third foul with like 8 minutes left in the second quarter. And I thought he actually played better defense after that by just like really trying hard not to foul, because he just commits so many dumb fouls, and did, of course, in this game as well, to get into foul trouble to begin with. I mean, that's the thing he can't afford. Like, all right, if you have some bigger guy going at you in the post and he's just steamrolling you over and you commit a foul, all right, I understand committing a foul in that situation, but he goes for all these dumb reach-ins that he has no chance of getting, or like tries to get an offensive board and will like commit a foul. Like, he really just does not have the level of discipline that he probably should have given his position. And I understand he's like a great steals guy and a really good help defender, but got to be smarter, because that really is one of the few ways I think that they lose a game, is because he, I mean, we'll see against Cleveland because they're such a great opponent, but it really puts them behind the eight ball when he gets into early foul trouble like that.
I totally agree with you. And one other thing I think we should discuss from this game, beyond the Warriors playing well with JaVale McGee, especially in that first quarter, is Davis Bertans was involved in two of the biggest highlights of this game. One was his absolutely ridiculous dunk on, well, I'm not sure if it was necessarily on anyway. It was just a really nice dunk.
It was a really nice tip dunk, yeah.
And then the other one was him just getting crumpled by a Draymond Green crossover, which I believe is the first time I can remember Draymond Green making a guy fall over with a dribble move.
Yeah, not something that you see that often. But I thought Bertans, other than that, he had a couple of nice plays in rim protection. He's actually much better protecting the rim than you would expect. I think he did get pulled after he, you know, gave up a backdoor to Kevin Durant and, you know, made a couple of rookie mistakes and Pop took him out. But they had their best stretch of the game when he was in there. And LaMarcus Aldridge continued to struggle. And the thing that's most mystifying about him, Zach Lowe had this stat, but I'd been kind of tracking it as well. He's shooting only 29% on long twos in the playoffs. And, you know, like we said, him posting up against these great defenders that Golden State has, the double teams that they're sending, their great help defense, he's not going to be efficient against this team the way he was at times against Houston. But like, why can't the guy hit a damn pick and pop jumper? Like, especially when he's being guarded by JaVale McGee. Pop went, I thought he had a nice move to go to Kyle Anderson just to force McGee to guard Aldridge, and I thought that was a positive matchup for Aldridge, and Aldridge was able to eat on him early in the third quarter, and Mike Brown, despite JaVale's 16 first half points, took JaVale out and he never came back in. I thought that was actually a good move. I like Mike Brown's aggressiveness so far to go to his good lineups, other than, you know, in game one when they were getting killed in the first half. I think that was a weird aberration, perhaps because of Iguodala's injury and effectiveness. But then, I mean, Aldridge had plenty of other like spot up jump and he was just like passing them up or just not hitting them. And Pau Gasol too, he had some hilarious reactions in this game, like when he committed that really bad and one on David West after he missed a jumper. He like had these weird gesticulations when he missed a wide open three as well. Like, his jump shot has been off. And Patty Mills has been erased from the series by Klay Thompson, and when he is open, he hasn't been able to hit. So, but I mean, this is not a surprise. The Spurs don't have anyone to do anything off the dribble. I mean, Manu was great. John Simmons didn't shoot that well. He was only 7 of 17 and didn't get to the foul line, 0-4 on threes, but he at least provided some juice off the dribble with that ready floater game. DeJounte Murray, same thing. So they had some guys, but those guys are just, you know, not a substitute for Kawhi Leonard or Tony Parker. And this is even with Parker and Leonard healthy, this is a team that doesn't have a ton of juice off the bounce.
So yeah, I mean, it looks like we're going to see game five. I mean, when you think about this game, the Warriors started out pretty flat, and the fact, you know, the Spurs were staying in it. They actually had the lead at the end of the first quarter and they still lost by double digits. So that doesn't bode well as long as Kawhi sits out. And I fully expect him to, without any more specific knowledge, just because the incentives here are so low.
Matt Barnes did get some time early. He was horrible, negative 10 in 5 minutes as the Spurs went on their run at the end of the first quarter. He was really bad in game one, has not looked good at all since returning from that ankle injury, especially with a smaller team. Pat McCaw has played much better. He was plus 9, another 2 steals, 6 points. He really continues to look very good. And the Spurs team doesn't really have anyone who's going to take advantage of him in the post defensively. And I think, you know, he's a great option guarding ones or twos at this point. Like, his feet are really, really quick. So I think to the extent they can, Barnes should just not play. I mean, he's been so slow, he can't stay in front of anybody. Like the couple possessions he tried to guard Kawhi Leonard in game one were just a joke. So I think he's got to just be relegated to the back of the rotation, and more McCaw, especially if Iguodala, who only played 19 minutes in this one, is going to struggle a bit. We might see maybe McCaw. I think that he probably should play more than Ian Clark against the Cavs, just because there's really nowhere for Ian Clark to hide. He's just too small and too slow, whereas McCaw, I think, can actually be a positive option guarding someone like Kyrie. So that'll be interesting. But we're getting into finals preview territory here.
But we're not going to have long to preview the finals, so we need to get it in there now.
Oh, man. All right, so we're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll be back talking about the All-NBA teams and Jonathan Isaac right after this word from our friends at Bespoke Post. I don't really enjoy the process of shopping, but I do enjoy the process of buying things that are really going to improve my life, and that's what Bespoke Post is for. Now you don't have to spend a bunch of time window shopping. You don't have to spend a ton of time comparing stuff online. Bespoke Post is a subscription club for guys. The boxes are $45 and they revolve around themes like grooming, food, drink, travel, any category a guy would care about. I already got their Weekender bag, which was not something that I really felt like I needed. It's a beautiful classic look just for going on a quick weekend trip. They sent me this really nice kit for making Moscow mules. They have a beautiful DOP kit that's available in one of the packages right now as well. And the way it works is on the first of every month, you get a box assigned to you. Then you can go through and click if you want a different one, or you can actually skip any box you want with no penalty. So you're signed up for this. They send you great products, things that you're probably not going to come across, but are really worthwhile stuff for any guy. And then if it's not your thing, you can always opt out of it. So there's really no risk at all to joining up. The way to do that, trythepost.com/capspace is the URL. Trythepost.com/capspace. That'll get you 20% off your first box. And that's an excellent value because they promise you at least a $70 value or more in each box that they give you. It only costs $45 before you get, of course, that 20% off using that /capspace URL. One more time, trythepost.com/capspace, or you could always use just that promo code capspace as well. Any capspace option you want to use there, and you know you can remember that code because we talk about it all the time in the program. trythepost.com/capspace. So Danny, the all NBA teams came out on Thursday. If you are a Patreon subscriber, you're actually getting this on Thursday. We are appending it to Dunked on Friday. So don't worry, Dunked On listeners, you're not missing out on anything. But Patreon subscribers, you're getting a little something extra. The biggest news that came out of here, Danny, was that Paul George and Gordon Hayward did not make it. And in fact, it was not even particularly close. And I thought that was justified as well. But what are the ramifications of that?
The ramifications are a little bit different for the two different guys, because Gordon Hayward is a free agent this year, so that means he is not eligible
if he wants to be. Yeah, he could decline his player option. Yeah,
so yeah, assuming he declines it, which he should, then he is not eligible for the supermax this year, and that means that the margins between Utah's offer and everyone else's offer are narrower than they were before. Paul George could theoretically get it next year, but that means he is not eligible for the designated veteran extension now. So that reduces Indiana's flexibility because they can't make him that offer presently, and you can't do anything contingent or anything of that sort. So it'll be harder, though, if they want to keep him, it's a more risky game.
Yeah, let's run through just what the teams were. James Harden was a unanimous vote for the first team at guard. Russell Westbrook got 99 out of a possible 100 first team votes. So did LeBron James. Kawhi Leonard got 96 out of a possible 100 first team votes. And then interestingly, Anthony Davis received 45 out of 100 first team votes, but was classified as a center. And the way it works is whichever position he has voted on it on more ballots, that's the position that he's at. But then you get all of your first place votes, no matter what position they were voted at. So it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of those, actually probably every single one of those first team votes you'd have to imagine was for him at center, because it's hard to see how he would have exceeded LeBron James or Kawhi Leonard at forward. Davis got 45 first team votes, 34 second team, and 16 third team. And that put him just ahead of Rudy Gobert, beating him out by only 4 points. Gobert had 43 first team votes to Davis's 45. But I don't have a problem with that. I think Anthony Davis is probably better than Rudy Gobert. And just a shame for Davis that he got voted onto an All-NBA team at center this year when he really didn't play substantially that much more than he did last year, and didn't even really play center substantially that much more than he did last year in the end. But now I think people were just more comfortable with him at center, but now it's too late for him to get that extra $25 million bucks that he would have gotten.
It is a shame for him, and it'll eventually, it won't won't eventually work out for him, but hopefully it leads to a better structure. And overall, I would say I'm happier with these results. Second team, as you mentioned, Gobert. The guards are Steph Curry and Isaiah Thomas. And then the second team forwards are Giannis and Kevin Durant.
Very interesting. Steph Curry got 93 second team votes, but Isaiah actually got 71 second team votes. John Wall only 19. So it seemed pretty clear. I didn't think that it was like that obvious between Thomas and John Wall that Thomas had a better season. But, you know, with the clutch stuff, I understand why they decided to go in that direction. And then did we say who the forwards and center were?
Yeah, I went through the whole second team. So Giannis, Durant, and Rudy.
Yeah, sorry. I was trying to calculate up what the numbers were as you were talking.
Yours.
Yeah, so again, it seemed pretty clear. Giannis, 81 second team votes. Kevin Durant, 66. And their competition on the third team, Draymond Green and Jimmy Butler, got 21 and 19 second team votes, respectively. So it seemed pretty clear that Giannis and KD were the guys that the voters really had focused in on. I thought Butler had a decent argument to maybe be ahead of Giannis by the end of the year, but certainly understand why. You know, I think Giannis and KD are probably better than Butler and Draymond, obviously. So no real problems, to be honest, with the first and second teams for me.
My biggest point of contention is more on the third team, but it affects the whole second and third, which is that I feel voters went way too far in terms of players that were in a lot of games. I thought that the guys who missed time were unfairly hurt by it, except for Durant. Kyle Lowry didn't get a single vote. I think Lowry had a wonderful season. He missed time. Chris Paul is completely ludicrous. Chris Paul was the third or fourth best guard in the NBA this year. And for him to not make it just because he missed time, I personally think that's unfair. And it's a personal thing. I mean, there is no clear rubric that I've ever seen for what all NBA is, but I go more to more outstanding than more valuable.
Yeah, the only difference in the first and second teams with what I had was I had Jimmy Butler actually ahead of Giannis for second team All-NBA when we did our awards over a month ago now. Not that anything should have changed between now and then, of course. And then third team, I had Chris Paul really should have been on there to me over DeMar DeRozan. Like, that's just a travesty that DeRozan made it over Chris Paul. I would also have had Damian Lillard well ahead of DeRozan. I even probably would have had Klay Thompson ahead of DeRozan as well, just due to Thompson's defense and the effect that his spacing has. I mean, DeRozan looks so much better by his box score stats, whereas Klay Thompson, I think, especially when you consider his defensive box score stats as well and the effect that those have on his RPM, looks so much worse by his box score stats, because, you know, Klay Thompson, you just cannot leave him for a single second. Whereas DeMar DeRozan, if he doesn't have the ball in his hands, you can help off of him plenty. And then obviously Thompson is so much better defensively. It's ridiculous. So I thought DeRozan shouldn't have been anywhere near these teams. That was the one issue that I had with that third team, which again, we'll say.
Oh, I don't think that's your only issue with the third team.
Well, I said the biggest issue. Isn't that what I said?
Oh, I thought you said only. Okay.
Maybe I misspoke, but Green and Butler at forward, John Wall and DeRozan at guard, and DeAndre Jordan was the center. And interestingly, third team center was probably the most contentious spot on the ballot. Jordan had 18 votes for the third team, but I think lucked out with 3 for first team and 7 for second team. So he had 54 total points. Carl Towns was a mere 4 points behind him with 50. Then Marc Gasol had 48. DeMarcus Cousins had 42 points. We don't get to see exactly. Carl Towns had 2 first team votes. Marc Gasol had 0 first team votes, and DeMarcus Cousins had 2 first team votes. So very close.
Gasol had two. He had 2 first team votes. It was just a poorly formatted document.
Oh yeah. Oh, it's on the next line. I see there. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. So really, the competition between those guys was incredibly close, and someone even voted Nikola Jokic as the first team center, although he only had 12 votes overall.
Congratulations to Adam Maris for getting a vote. But I think what I think is the most important in some ways takeaway for me is that none of the snubs are being hurt by it in terms of money. This is not what it was last year, because I don't think that Paul George or Gordon Hayward deserved. They weren't among the 6 best forwards in the league.
Yeah.
So they were hurt by not making it, but I don't think they deserved it. So
yeah, sorry, George 40 points, Hayward 27 points. So well below Green, who had 134 points, and Butler had 102 on that third team forward position.
Right. So I'm fine with that as an overall result. I am as aggrieved with DeRozan making it over the other guys as you, actually more so because I had Chris Paul second team. But that's, you know, in terms of levels of frustration, it's lower than last year, which is nice.
So now we get to the implications, and we've talked about these before, but it's good to reiterate some of these. Gordon Hayward, had he made All-NBA, could have opted in for next year, but received the designated player extension. The thing is that you can't have the extension kick in until you have 8 years of experience. He currently only has 7, but if he opts in for next year, then at the end of next year, he's got the 8 years of experience. He could have tacked on that 5-year over $200 million extension after last year, probably would have then wanted to opt in, even though he's only making $16 million for next year. That didn't happen. So now Hayward almost certainly going to opt out. He could, in theory, just opt in for next year. But even if you're going to do that, you might as well just take a 1+1, get up to the max this year, and then try to get the qualify with All-NBA next year. But I mean, I don't think his odds are really that great of making All-NBA next year. So with just the incredible depth there is at the forward position right now, like KD, LeBron James, Kawhi, Draymond, Giannis, like those dudes aren't going anywhere. You know, maybe he could hope to eke out, and that's 7 guys right there. And then AD could maybe be considered a forward next year as well. He's playing next to Cousins.
And remember, like, yeah. Durant made a team despite being hurt this year. So he has to even get past that sort of a thing.
Right. And I mean, Golden State, Spurs, Cleveland, like those teams are all going to be good next year too. So it's not like they're going to be hurt in that space. George could bump up ahead of him again. I mean, I would say his chances of making All-NBA next year are like well below 20%. So it doesn't really make a ton of sense. I think you got to get the money while the getting's good after you've had the best seasons of your career as a free agent. George now ineligible to receive that designated player veteran extension. A regular extension won't be enough. They could only offer him 20% on top of his salary for next year, which is not very much. They could actually try to renegotiate and extend him using their cap space, but that would mean that their flexibility would be highly limited this year. They might not be able to afford to re-sign Jeff Teague as well if they were to do that. So that's certainly an issue. And again, he can only get, you know, the 30% max at this point, not the 35%. He could, however, if they just stays on the Pacers, because remember, once you get traded after the first 4 years of your contract, you're ineligible for that designated veteran extension with another team. But he could hope to just stay with the Pacers. The Pacers could hope that he makes an All-NBA team next year and then would be eligible. But again, I mean, he's facing the same issues. You know, I would put his odds at making an All-NBA team next year below 50%, especially because the Pacers might not be that good next year. They don't have a ton of ways to improve. We talked about that on the Pacers offseason preview. So yeah, I mean, I don't think either of those guys deserve to make it. This isn't some huge injustice, but again, it casts light on how ridiculous the system is, where the media is trying to decide how much you can pay a guy instead of just the team having the option of just paying him whatever max they want to pay him, which would be 35%, which actually would also correlate more with when guys are good in their career, making the 35% max only available to guys who qualify for this, you know, after their 8th year, or for other players who don't qualify after their 10th year. Makes no sense at all to me, but you know, that's how they've decided to do it, and at least gives us something to talk about.
I agree with you on the uniform max. I think that's a way to fix the problem, but there are two other designated veteran things that we need to discuss that are a little bit more under the radar just because they're not as pressing, but they both could be relevant. So one is, as a formality, Kawhi Leonard is now eligible for it regardless of what happens next season, because he's gotten it in 2 of 3 years. And that will be an interesting question. We've talked about how 2018 is the year for the Spurs to spend their money. And of course, that won't affect it because he'll still be under contract. It would come in after. And then the other guy is John Wall. John Wall signed his extension back in 2013, but it was a full 5-year one. So he could theoretically sign a designated veteran extension this summer that would kick in 2 years from now, 2 seasons from now, and then extend another 4 years. And that actually might make some sense for the Wizards, just because you're not committing as much on the downside, and for Wall, you're locking that in without risk.
Yeah, at least you're only going in 4 years. It still could be a very ugly contract by the end. He would be making $44 million as a 32-year-old, but you know, at least you keep him happy there. And by the way, if you listen to yesterday's Wizards preview, I fixed this, but I had forgotten that Wall actually does have enough experience to get that extension. So if you heard that yesterday, we are correcting that error now. I apologize for that. Another interesting one, Klay Thompson, had he made an All-NBA team this year, would have been eligible next year. Now he will not be. And unless he makes all NBA next year, which again, I would say is probably less likely. So that will mean that he will have to actually become a free agent. They won't be able to pay him enough in an extension and probably actually saves the Warriors, because I don't know if they would have been interested in paying him a 5-year designated veteran max after next year. And you got to pay Curry and you got to pay Durant, and then you'd have to pay Draymond Green again.
It also avoids a really awkward circumstance, which they'll have another awkward circumstance on top of it, because since Durant is ineligible for the designated veteran and Curry is definitely going to get it, then you have to, theoretically, they would have to choose between Thompson and Green. Thompson coming a free agent a year before, that could be a little bit awkward. If Thompson doesn't qualify, then they still might have an awkward situation if they don't want to pay Green that full amount, but at least then they don't have to choose between the two.
Yeah, either of those contracts, again, for those guys, I think would end up being a really bad deal. But at least, you know, do you think the Warriors would be in contention, so it's worth keeping everyone together on the early end of that, and then you just bite the bullet at the end. Anything else we need to say about these all NBA teams?
No, I'm very excited to see where, like, who from the group below, other than the injury related guys like Chris Paul, jumps in. I think Karl Anthony Towns has a wonderful shot at it, and the forward spots are going to be brutal, but the guard spots are too. I mean, we'll see what kind of competitive teams these guys are on, but we could see a pretty stable all NBA group next year after we had a lot of new additions this year.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, actually. That's a good question of who do you think is the most likely to drop out of this group for next year. I would say Isaiah would be one. I would say DeRozan would be another.
DeAndre.
I mean, although, like, those, of course, those guys are probably like DeRozan and DeAndre are the three that we think are the most overrated. You know, I could see maybe Draymond dropping out just because, like, you know, he doesn't win Defensive Player of the Year next year because everyone's just, he won it this year and he just doesn't have as much attention on him. Like, even, and I think he is going to start dropping off a little bit at some point here too. I mean, just as an undersized guy getting into his late 20s, that didn't happen this year, but it might happen next year. Yeah, who do you think is the most likely you didn't make it this year to make it next year?
Chris Paul. I had him as the fifth best player in the league, so Chris Paul.
Yeah, but I mean, he always misses time, is that's where my concern is.
Well, and he also might be on a worse team.
Yeah, that's a good point too. I think Karl Towns probably, I mean, Karl Towns is just going to, if he stays healthy and he hasn't had even the slightest injury in his career yet. Joel Embiid might be another one, but of course,
wait, can we have a quick open question about, I want to see who voted for DeMarcus Cousins' first team center?
We don't know yet. We don't find out until the actual June 26th awards.
I really hope it's not people I know. Just like I hope it's not somebody that I know for the person who voted LeBron second team, just because I'm just going to give him crap.
Yeah, Jokic got a first team All-NBA vote too. So now I want to get into Florida State's Jonathan Isaac, an intriguing wing prospect. Isaac has been compared to Kevin Durant in some respects just because he's a skinny guy who can shoot and has a pretty long reach. He's nowhere near in that class of a prospect, both in terms of his measurements and his shooting abilities. Got a 7'1 wingspan, Durant is 7'5, and a 9'0 standing reach. But Danny, for what he is, I think that those are pretty good measurements, and I gotta say, I was impressed by a lot of aspects of him as a prospect.
So we saw Isaac back at the Hoop Summit in 2016, so a year ago, and what impressed me then and still does is that the only other guy we've talked about is Jason Tatum, and I feel like with Jason Tatum, a lot of what he does well is not necessarily applicable at the NBA level, or at least not valuable. With Isaac, I see how it could work, and that's always encouraging.
Yeah, it is. He's not the isolation scorer that Tatum is. But I gotta say, actually, I like him better than Tatum for the NBA. I think that I guess it's probably just the way to do it is to start by describing his game. He is a solid shooter. I wouldn't say an unbelievable shooter, but has good form, pretty quick release. He'll catch it on the hop and he can get it off pretty quickly. At Florida State, he had a little bit of an interesting role. They had a very egalitarian system. They played 12 deep a lot of times, so he didn't play nearly as many minutes. And most of his possessions came from spot-ups, so he didn't have as much chance to spread his wings as an individual scorer. And I think that a lot of that has work. I wouldn't predict that he's going to be a tremendous isolation scorer, but I like the idea that he can be good to very good in a lot of different different aspects, someone who really is going to fit well in the modern NBA. I see him as a pretty good shooter, not going to be maybe a 40% guy from three, but someone who could make like 36 to 38% in time. Like, his stroke is very easy. It's projectable. I think he's going to have no problem in time adapting to the NBA three. He gets his legs into his shot. Shot only 35% on threes at Florida State, but that's not damning to me at all. And he was taking some difficult attempts. So there's that aspect. I think he's going to be a solid shooter.
Well, on that note, Andrew Johnson of Nylon Calculus is doing projections. He released those over the last couple of days, and his projections for Jonathan Isaac are 35% from three and 79% from the line. And I think he can improve from that point. But if that's kind of an understanding of maybe an optimistic place to start, I'm good with that.
Yeah, and those projections consider both free throw percentage, college 3-point percentage, but also, which I think is a very underrated aspect, his volume. And I think he's going to have a higher volume than some of the guys that we're looking at, like a Josh Jackson or Tatum. He is still rail thin and turns 20 in October. So he's not, you know, he's probably almost a year older than Brandon Ingram, you know, who had a somewhat similar body type was. But what I really like about him is I think that he can be a combo forward in a lot of units at the next level. He's probably going to struggle to guard real strong post-up fours, but how many of those are really left there? And I was really impressed by just how hard he competes defensively and on the boards. He really likes to use his body. Like, the rare times that they posted him up, he actually like uses his body well. He boxes out very hard. So even though he's thin, he uses his abilities as best he can. And as he gets stronger, that's only going to improve. And then the way he reacts to the ball on rebounding is really very impressive, considering the stretch role that he had. 7.7% offensive rebounds is actually pretty good. And then his defensive rebounding, really outstanding. He played mostly at the four, but 25% defensive rebounds, which is quite excellent. And then he also had a 6.8% two-point block rate and a reasonable steal rate as well. So that was pretty impressive, I thought. That I think he can block some shots in time, that he can defensive rebound well enough as a four. And then also, I think that his ability on the perimeter can get to be pretty good. I mean, he's never going to be amazing, but, you know, if he's in an isolation, he can actually get down. Like, Florida State played like a pressure system. He was comfortable getting down deep into a stance, guarding out on the floor, even at the four. So I think he can be a switch guy. He's not necessarily going to be like chasing guys over screen, like a lockdown type of guy, but I really like him as a combo forward, you know, maybe a guy who could start at the three and then move to the four, you know, when you're in your closing lineup, play a lot of four, play some four and bench units. And because that's just the effort and the floor game were things that I really appreciated about him that I wasn't expecting to see given his body type. I expected he would be a poor rebounder, and that really just is not the case at all. He rebounds out of his area. He gets his hands on balls with his long reach. He's able to bring it in. You know, if he's standing at the dotted line on a defensive rebound and it goes off the rim, he explodes towards the ball and grabs it. Very impressed with his ability to pursue the ball off the glass.
He and Tatum are both players that I've thought of as potentially defending both forward positions that might eventually slide to the three, not out of that being their better position. Both are just like every other guy. They're better offensively as power forwards. But Isaac intrigues me because I think that can kind of work to a point to his advantage. As you said, his isolation defense, it makes me a little bit queasy in that stage. But if it's more of a kind of a spot thing, like he does it for specific moments, I'm far more okay with it. And what did you think of him as like a potentially a weak side shot blocker? Because that was something more in the workout phase last year that intrigued me about him.
Yeah, I think you know, that block percentage is good on ball. Like, in the post, he really wasn't as effective because he kind of get knocked backwards a little bit and wasn't able to affect the jump hooks of like some traditional fours that he had to guard. But yeah, I thought coming over, he's got quick feet. I thought he showed like pretty good basketball IQ in the games that I watched, as far as communicating defensively, rotating over. So yeah, I mean, I don't think he's going to be like just erasing shots at the rim, but I think he can affect people there. We haven't talked much yet about his offense, only 20% usage, you know, and again, they had a lot of guys on this team who took shots, and most of what he was doing was spotting adding up. So you really have to look at snippets to see if he can do stuff beyond that. But what I feel very confident that he can do is be effective driving on closeouts. He has a really nice first step, really nice jab step game. And unlike maybe someone like Tatum, who also has great footwork, he really covers some ground once he gets the guy off balance, like either with a first step that's kind of to the side, but he's so fast that he can blow by guys, or he can, if the guy cuts him off, he can do like a quick behind the back and pull up, which, you know, I didn't make that many of, but he's got a skill level in that area to take one dribble and pull up, or two dribbles and pull up, change direction. But I thought his ability to get to the rim off of closeouts, which he's going to be facing a lot of, obviously, as a decent shooter, it was impressive. Did not see a ton of passing ability on those plays. You know, there wasn't many in terms of drive and kick. He only had 35 assists all year. And his finishing at the rim is a mixed bag. He is pretty explosive, above average, I would say, as a leaper off of 2 feet. Doesn't really ever finish with one hand. I think he might just have small hands and have difficulty gripping the ball. You won't really see like one-handed dunks from him unless it's a tip dunk. And then off of 1 foot, he does have trouble exploding. He'll be kind of off balance, which is surprising. Usually guys with his body type will be better 1 foot jumpers than 2 foot jumpers. That's not the case for him. But he, let's say if he's driving to the basket and he's got someone on his hip, he does have difficulty exploding once he has someone on his hip to really finish. Hopefully as he gets stronger, that's something that he can improve on. But again, I thought his ability to get into the lane off of closeouts was pretty good. It's just that, so I am pretty confident that he can be a guy who, you know, kind of like maybe like a little bit sweeter shooting, longer Otto Porter, you know, someone like that. I mean, that's not his floor, obviously, because guys can get injured or just never develop or whatever. But I see that as someone who's at least average on both ends of the floor and can shoot, and with a bit more ability to play as a small ball four than someone like Porter.
The NBA also needs low usage guys. You know, obviously there are guys that can, that handle the ball or have a large role in their offense in college and then scale it down. That can work well. There are lots of guys that have done that, but you need players that can fit in the other spots and are okay with that. And
yeah, he's a really good cutter too, by the way, actually. Yeah. He changes direction very quickly. So he can be popping out and then immediately cut hard back door and get open. And he was outstanding finishing on cut. So that was another part of that kind of complimentary game that we might see from him.
And it also ties in with something that was unusual but intriguing about his time at Florida State, which was how egalitarian their approach was, not only in terms of minutes, but in terms of shots and distribution.
Yeah, so as a result of that, we didn't see him do much in terms of pick and rolls, but there are flashes there. If Mike Schmitz hasn't come out with his video yet, but I'm guessing he will have a section in the strengths called like pick and roll flashes, where he is comfortable shooting off the dribble if the defense goes either over or under the screen. Didn't make that many of those, but again, that, you know, that's a small sample. It's harder to shoot off the dribble. He had a couple of really awesome plays where he just split the pick and roll. Most of his pick and rolls were off of drag screen situations in transition. He's definitely comfortable bringing the ball up as a grab and go guy. So we saw some of that. They didn't really run much pick and roll for him in just a static half court situation, really. Again, in the post, like I think he's got a nice turnaround going either direction. Didn't ever see much jump hook game. Again, you don't see him get like any extension with one hand on any of these finishes, which is a concern for me as far as like eventually being able to finish and be really more of a primary guy. You know, I don't ever see him as a number one option. Maybe he could get to a number two because he does have a nice handle in ISO. He wasn't really blowing by guys. Doesn't have a ton of advanced moves. You know, he has this crossover that's pretty quick. He has like a quick behind the back as well, but he got that ripped up a couple of times. You know, wasn't really that effective in isolation, but again, you know, not something that he was asked to do a ton of. So creating his own offense, not really that great. I liked what I saw from him as a passer. Florida State, for whatever reason, faced a lot of zone. And so he actually would throw some pretty nice entry passes, like lobs over the top to post players just from a standstill. Still didn't really see any passing from him on the move that much, but he operated mostly as a play finisher. So again, wasn't asked to do that as much. So there's a question to me of, you know, how far can he evolve as an individual offensive player, creating offense for himself and others. But I like his intensity. I think the fact that he's got this nice turnaround, the fact that he's willing to work hard for position against switches, I think he can at least be an option in the post in time against guys like that. So I see him as someone who has a pretty high high floor, because I think he can always be effective as a role player, a decent two-way guy who can play the three and the four, probably more the four even in the modern NBA, hold up well enough on the boards, get out in transition, make cuts, hit shots, defend the rim well defensively. You know, probably he probably offers more shot blocking than your typical NBA four does at this point in time. So all of that is good, and it's just a question of, you know, I think he does have some upside. He's got to get stronger, has to get more explosive, got to get some more moves, refine his shot. Like, there's a long way to go in terms of actually being a creator, but I just like the way he fits into the modern NBA much more than someone like Tatum.
So a place that I've been drooling over the fit for a little while now is the idea of him playing next to Towns in Minnesota.
That's where he's projected right now by Draft Express.
It is. I just think that fit is wonderful because he can grow into it, and they actually have some kind of wiggle room on the wing just because they're figuring out what they have, guys like Bielitsa and everything else. And so you make it work with him, and then if he ends up being more of a three, then you can go in some different directions. And I just think that would be a wonderful place for him, but he might go higher than that.
Yeah, the other thing too I didn't see much of from him was, you know, coming off of screens. He only had two possessions coming off of screens for jumpers all year as well. I think that's, he can get to have the footwork to do that in time, potentially, certainly from 2-point range. I don't know about from 3-point range necessarily. And he's got to really work on like his Euro step game too. You know, we didn't see much of that from him. You'll see hints of it every once in a while, but again, because he doesn't have as much 1-foot explosiveness and doesn't get that much extension on his finishes, there's a little bit less in that maybe you'll see from some other guys with his type of length. So I still don't know whether he can develop the finishing around the rim and the individual offensive game, but I think he can just be, you know, Minnesota, I agree with you. I think that fit, it could be pretty solid there. You know, I don't know if he's like a Tibbs type of guy, but I mean, I don't know anything about him personally, but I was impressed by how hard he competed. And I think part of the fact that he was at Florida State, he had to be competing for minutes, that he wasn't playing that many minutes, he was allowed to play hard and taught how to play hard in that setting, I think was good.
The other fit that I really like for him, I talked about this a little bit actually with Sam Vecenie on Real Jam Radio, we released that on Friday, is the idea if Denver traded up and was able to get him maybe in something involving Orlando, because they could just give him one of their million shooting guards, go in that direction and get up there. But again, next to Jokic, I think that could work reasonably well. And again, they're another team that doesn't need a lot of usage compared to all the other guys they have. So they need somebody who can play off ball, who can be active and then defend. And Isaac can do that, certainly.
Yeah, so just to sum up here, the things that impressed me the most about him, solid shooting ability, first step, the amount of ground that he covers with his first step and with his jab step one way, go the other way. I think he also, when he was effective in pick and roll, I thought he was best rejecting the screen because he was able to just straight line it and explode past his guy. Just solid defensively out on the floor, not amazing, but for a freshman, not bad. And you know, the shot blocking, the length, like all, just the lack of huge weaknesses, I think, at least if you're going to try and project him out, is what I like about him. All right, I think that'll do it for tonight's show. Thanks so much for watching. Hopefully we'll have a little bit more competition here going forward, but even if we don't, stick with us for more off-season previews, more draft coverage as well. I'm getting into that now, getting pretty fired up. We'll probably check out Josh Jackson next. I've been enjoying comparing and contrasting some of these wing guys at the top of the draft. Also, don't forget about our Patreon subscribers, of course, got that all NBA reaction a couple of days early, and we did an exclusive mailbag pod with questions by Patreon subscribers and obviously for Patreon subscribers as well. So please, if you haven't subscribed to that yet, we ask you to, both to support this and the Twitter NBA show, which is free. And all right, I think that's it. We'll talk to you all next time.